Okay, let's continue then. One thing that I didn't mention about Bayesian classification, which is very important, is how do you manage the unknown object case? As I said before, this system assumes that all of the objects that will appear in the image belong to one of the classes that the system knows. Or if you want, the system is always going to answer one of the known classes as its best choice. So if you want to manage the unknown object case, this can be done in a reasonably simple way, which is including an additional class, which is class 0, and we call this class the unknown object class. How do we model unknown objects? Well, so it's an unknown object, so we don't know anything about them. So what do? We say, okay, for a certain parameter or a descriptor, what we're going to assume is that the likelihood is a uniform distribution between the smallest value and the largest value possible for the descriptor, and the distribution is going to be uniform. So for example, we could, in the case of the area, say, well, an unknown object is going to have a uniform distribution of area between one pixel, or maybe it should be largest, slightly larger than noise, 50 pixels, and the half the size of the image, for example, uniformly distributed. So these minimum and maximum values are chosen with some sensible reason. And then the distribution, the likelihood of this class is very simply stated in this way. It's 0 for values smaller than the minimum, 0 for values larger than the maximum, and the distribution of probability is like this in case that the area is between the intervals. So after you do this, you simply include class 0 in all the classes that the system knows. And then if during the classification the system decides that the object is that is seeing is more closely related to this distribution than to the others, it's going to answer class 0. And you know that the answer means unknown object. This is then the reasonable way of including unknown objects in Bayesian classification. Simple, and it if the parameters are adequate, then it works reasonably well. Okay, so the basic full, or if you want, the full theoretical solution to recognition is the one that I just explained. There are simple alternatives which are basically based on the same idea, but with some simplifications, and I'm going to explain some of them. A group of these methods corresponds to what we call minimal distances. And it's basically working in this way. Suppose that I have a system with three classes, omega 1, 2, and 3. And I compute two descriptors, descriptor 1 and descriptor 2. So the information about that I have about the descriptor is the mean value of the descriptor. So omega 1 would be represented by the mean x1 and x2, omega 2 would be represented by this point, and omega 3 would be represented by that other point. If I get a sample like this to try to find out which object it might correspond to, then the method of minimal distances measures a distance between the sample and each of the points that represent each of the classes, and then simply answers the closest class to the sample, which in this case would be omega 3. Okay? How do you measure distance? Well, there's several alternatives. A very simple one, and maybe the immediate one that you can think of, is the Euclidean distance, which is simply measured in this way. And notice the following. Notice that in this method of distances, what the measurement is actually doing for you is separating or tessellating the space into separate regions. For example, all of this region is the region of points that if a sample appears in that region, the answer is going to be omega 3. And in this case, it's going to be omega 1, and in that case, it's going to be omega 2. This results in, or the effect is also known as the Voronoi tessellation, and it is the region of, in this 2D example, it's the region of all points that are close to a certain point, which in this case would be the different classes. So in this example, you would have all of those classes. Some are red and some are black. And what you see drawn is the region of all points that are closest to each of one of the representative points for the classes. So the method of minimal distances works in a very simple way. You plot the sample in the space, in the 2D space, and then find out in which region it fell, and then that's your answer. Okay? It's a very simple algorithm. How does this work? Well, you can try, for example, to see in this exercise what is the mean representative value and how to compute, let's say, the line that separates one region of acceptance of one class from the other, okay? You can try this as an exercise. So how does this relate to Bayesian classification? It relates in the following way. This is actually equivalent to Bayes' rule if all classes have the same a priori probability, okay, equal to 1 divided by n, and then all of the descriptors have the same variance. Because if you look at what I did, I was only using the mean, not the variance. So this is Bayesian classification, actually, when all the variances are the same. If I can measure all the descriptors with the same precision for all of the objects, then I can use a simple distance measurement instead of the full Bayesian solution with exactly the same answer. Okay? There's one important, a couple of important differences. One is that I will always choose a class. Or if you want, I could do something here. Suppose that this is my space and the point is over here. I'm going to choose class 1, even though it's very distant from all of the classes. Okay? So that method is going to choose always one class, except if I, for example, say, well, I'm only going to consider this region. If it falls out of this region for each of the objects, then the answer is unknown. I would have to arbitrarily say only points within this region are going to be recognized, and points outside, the answer is going to be unknown object. I could do that. So that's not a big problem. The biggest problem here is that when you're considering Euclidean distance, you are not taking into account, or you're assuming that the units of each of the parameters is the same. And that's not always the case. For example, in the descriptors that I always mention, one is the area in square meters, for example, and the other one is perimeter in meters, for example. So if you use Euclidean distance, you're measuring, you're mixing meters plus meters squared, or oranges with apples. That's, in general, not a good idea, because you can't, interpret very clearly what the distance means if the units are different. And a more important issue with Euclidean distance is that, actually, if you change the scale, for example, I was measuring x1 in meters, and I say, no, I'm going to measure it in centimeters. If I change the scale, then the result might be that the sample is actually closer now to this one, and it was before closer now to this other one. So the answer might be different depending on the units that you're using. So this is not a good idea, except if the units of all descriptors are the same. Okay? If the units are different, then you can use another distance, which is a statistical distance called Mahalanobis. There's a very deep interpretation in terms of statistics of the Mahalanobis distance, but I can explain in a very simple, give a simple interpretation. This is like Euclidean distance, as you see, The only difference is that I'm also using the variance, and I'm dividing the distance by the variance. This has several effects. The first one is that this distance is adimensional. No matter what the unit that you're using, since this would be square meters and this is divided by square meters again, then the distance doesn't have any unit. So you can mix oranges and apples using Mahalanobis distance. You can mix area and perimeter because the units are going to disappear in the distance. The second useful thing is that graphically, the Mahalanobis distance defines elliptical regions of pixels or points that are at the same distance from the class. In this example, you have class 1 and class 2. And if you say, okay, I'm going to draw the region of all the points that are at distance 1, then in the case of class 2, you have this ellipse, and in the case of class 1, you have the smaller ellipse. And there are several things that you can see here. The first one is omega 1 has descriptors that can be measured much more precisely than omega 2. And you can see that by the size of, or by the size of the ellipse, or by the size of the value of the eigenvalues. Okay? Small eigenvalues, very precise measurements. Large eigenvalues, like omega 2, less precise measurements. So this is one important thing. The other important thing is that if your sample is x, like you can see in the graph, if you use Euclidean distance, then omega 1 is closer. But if you use Mahalanobis distance, then omega 2 is closer. How do I know that? Because x is within this ellipse right here, okay? And it's outside this one. And this ellipse, as I tell you, it represents points at distance 1 from the class. So x is at distance less than 1 from class 2 and more than 1 from class 1. Okay? So Mahalanobis distance will give you a different answer from Euclidean distance. What does this mean? This basically means that I can measure omega 1, its descriptors, very precisely. So if x is at this distance, it's less likely that the answer is omega 1, because if it were, I could measure those values with very high precision. Instead, if it might be omega 2, because since I can't measure them so precisely, then maybe the answer is omega 2. So this means basically that the system believes the distance more or less depending on the value of the variance. High variance, less confidence in the distance. Small variance, larger confidence in the distance. So it's like distance, but modulated using the variance of the descriptor. That's a too simple, maybe, explanation for Mahalanobis distance. But essentially, that's the way in which it works. So there's also a more formal statistical interpretation for Mahalanobis distance. And let me just simply say that if we are modeling the likelihood of descriptors using Gaussians, as we said before, then if one parameter has this Gaussian distribution, when I subtract the mean and the variance, you know that then this new value has the standard Gaussian distribution. If I square the value, which is the Mahalanobis distance, then this value follows a distribution that's called the chi-squared distribution. If I'm adding m different values like this, then the distribution of the sum is the chi-squared distribution with m degrees of freedom. And we know from statistics that if the Mahalanobis distance follows this chi-squared distribution, then I can perform a hypothesis test on whether a certain sample belongs to a certain class in this simple way. This maybe it's simpler to look at the example. This test basically says, if my system measures two descriptors, then if I measure the distance of a certain sample to a certain class, The distance is going to be less than 5.99 in 95% of the cases. Okay? And that's why you have chi-square tables in most books and statistics. This table tells you the Mahalanobis distance of one descriptor is going to be less than 3.84 in 95% of the cases. It's going to be less than 6.64 in 99% of the cases. So this alpha value of 0.5, or in this case 0.1, is what we call the confidence level. Okay? It's if you want, it's the percentage of false negatives that the system will have. So this works in the following way. I will use the Mahalanobis distance to measure the distance to all of the classes, and I will only accept the hypothesis of those objects that pass this test, that basically pass the test. The distance is less than the limit for my confidence level. And among all the objects that pass the test, I will choose the one that has the smallest distance. That is the way in which classification using Mahalanobis distance is going to work. What is this system, how is it going to behave? Suppose I use confidence 0.05, I'm sorry. This means that this system is going to fail in 5% of the executions. It's a probabilistic system. So the system of 100 times that you will show it a square, 5 times it's going to say it's not a square, even if it is. That's what we call false negatives. The system says no, and the answer is yes. Okay? That failure percentage is measured by the confidence level. Do you want a smaller confidence level, 0.01, only one in 100 false negatives? Then you, of course, have to use a larger value for the distance. As you can see, the value of the distance increases with the decrease in the confidence level. Of course, it has to accept a larger interval if the negatives, false negatives, are going to be less. Okay? So this would be the way in which a recognition system based on Mahalanobis distance would work. And there's several interpretations that we make. I'm afraid we don't have time. If we have time at the end, we'll make this exercise. There's a clear graphical interpretation of Mahalanobis distance, which is basically this one. If I'm only using one descriptor, then my distribution for a certain parameter is this Gaussian. Okay? So the Mahalanobis distance is this paraboloid. It's centered around the mean because the Mahalanobis distance of a sample, when the value is exactly the mean, is zero. Okay? And it increases monotonically as the sample gets further away from the mean in one direction or in the other direction, because it's a squared distance. The value of the chi-square distribution, which in this case is 3.84, is basically setting you an interval of acceptance for possible values for this parameter. Basically, if you choose this value, then the system will say, if the sample is in this interval, the answer is yes. And if the sample is outside, then the answer is no. Okay? So in one dimension, when you choose the confidence value, you are actually setting intervals of acceptance for each of the classes. As I said before, the answer is not going to be the same with Mahalanobis distance than with the Euclidean distance. And you can see that in this example. If you have these two classes and the measurement is this one, then it's closer actually to this class using Mahalanobis distance than to this one, even if the Euclidean distance is smaller in this case than in the other case. You can also see that the way in which the function of the Mahalanobis distance is more open in this case than in this other one, because this first class is more precise. So the interval of acceptance is going to be smaller, And in this case, the interval of acceptance is going to be larger. As I said before, the intuitive explanation is, I believe less measurements of less precise descriptors. So since this one is more precise, then the value has to be closer, because I know how to measure that descriptor very well. That would be basically the intuitive interpretation of the Mahalanobis distance. Okay. I mentioned initially that one important thing that you should be able to do is decide whether your descriptors are good enough to distinguish between the objects that you have. Well, you can answer that also using the Mahalanobis distance between classes. So you can measure the Mahalanobis distance between class I and K, which has this general form. It's the square difference of the means divided by the sum of the variances. Okay? And that basically allows you to take the parameters that you know how to measure, take your database of objects that you know, and then answer the question, are these parameters good enough to distinguish between the objects? So you carry a hypothesis test, just as the one that I explained. You compute pairwise distances between all the objects, and if the distance is less than the limit set by the chi-square distribution for a pair of objects, that means that the two classes are indistinguishable. You need more parameters, or you need different parameters, because according to the ones that you have, the two classes could be the same. So you will not be able to distinguish between the two objects. Okay, so that allows you to analyze the system that you have defined to decide whether your parameters are good enough or not for the objects that you want to distinguish. Okay? This is also a comment about the number of samples in statistics. This is a very important issue. It's usually the case that we don't have enough samples, initially at least, of the objects that we want to know. For example, in our system we only have 5 samples, and that's a very small number. So we know that with a very small number of samples, we tend to underestimate the variance of a certain parameter. So there's a proposal to measure the variance in a slightly different way, which is this one. Basically, if you only have one sample, the variance is going to be 1% of the square value of the sample. Okay? And if you have more than one sample, then this is the way in which we're going to measure the variance. This is basically the same square differences with the mean, but divided by n instead of by n minus 1, and then you add that a priori estimation of variance. What? How does this work? Well, basically, this is equivalent to this, or this is related to the true variance in this way. So you can see the following here. What happens if n grows close to infinite? This is going to be 0, and this is going to be 1. So this measurement tends to the variance, the true variance, when n is very large. But it measures a larger value for the variance initially. So if you want, it takes more into account this initial value when n is very small. And if you make an example, like the one you see in the graph, you can see that the two variances tend to the same value, but initially this one is larger than the other one, which, as I said before, is usually underestimated. So this is a way to modify the measurement of the variance when the number of samples is very small. It can be important in some cases. Okay, those are the basic algorithms for Bayesian recognition. I have to tell you that there are some alternative algorithms that also are used in recognition, but work in slightly different ways. So let me give you some examples. One group of these systems are called decision trees, and they're very simple to understand. Basically, it's a tree whose nodes contain a question about the parameters of the system, and depending on whether the answer is yes or no, you take one road or you take the other. So in this case, you ask, is the number of holes greater than zero? If the answer is no, you go this way. Is the area greater than six? If the answer is yes, then the answer is this object. Okay? It's a simple system to explain and also to implement, and that's certainly an appeal. And another important thing is that in some recognition systems, the knowledge of experts is important. So this is a way to incorporate knowledge of experts in a simple way. There's an automatic system that's called CART that allows you to take Bayesian classifier and compute or produce the corresponding decision tree, which basically works. I don't have time to explain how it works, but it works in answering these questions. For example, which of the descriptors should I use for division in each node? When should the division stop? How fine should the grain be for the division? Can I optimize the tree in so that I ask the smallest number of questions that allow me to give an answer? This system resolves these six questions in generating a decision tree based on samples. And it's important to see that this is the way in which the decision trees work greatly depend on how the questions are asked. So if you have red samples for one object and black samples for the another object, you can actually make a tree like this, which basically divides the space into horizontal or vertical lines. Okay? If you see what the tree is asking, you will have to see. First question is x1. Is x1 smaller than 0.27, which is this value, this one? And then is x2 smaller than 0.32? And then basically what it's doing is trying to isolate these regions to be able to answer, to give an appropriate answer. So if x1 is smaller than 0.27 and x2 less than 0.32 and then x1 less than 0.07, the answer is omega 1, which is this case. Okay? It's obvious that this system is not very good because it asks many questions. And the reason it's not very good is the questions are always related to one single descriptor. If I make a linear combination of descriptors, like in this example, then I can solve this problem with just one question. Okay? So it's not obvious and very difficult to optimize trees so that you just have to ask a small number of questions to give an answer. Another criticism of decision trees is that what happens if I make an error in one descriptor? What happens if when I measure the area, there's an error for some reason? In Bayesian classifiers, you can tolerate a certain amount of errors, but not in decision trees. If there's a slightest error in one of the measurements, then the answer of the system is going to be, instead of no, yes, in one of these nodes, and then the solution might be completely different. So it's not robust to errors in the measurement of descriptors. And the final criticism of these systems is that it's very difficult to incorporate the unknown object. So they always decide one of the classes. You can incorporate the unknown object, and it has to be in many leaves all around the tree. Okay, it's not just one class. Well, it's one class, but it has to be represented in several leaves of the tree. So it's not easy to incorporate the unknown object in these cases. Let me finish by describing other methods, which are extremely simple and work surprisingly well. So all the methods that I've explained up to this moment are called parametric, in the sense that we estimate the parameters of the likelihood of function to characterize each of the objects that we know. Methods that are alternative, non-parametric, instead of estimating the mean and the variance for the descriptors, try to estimate the likelihood directly, even if it's not Gaussian, or try to estimate the a posteriori probability directly without applying Bayes' rule. This is a very simple one. This is a method, the window method. It's trying, basically, tries to estimate the a posteriori probability without applying the rule of Bayes. What does it do? It sets, so these are all the samples of all the objects that you know. This red one is your sample of the object that you want to recognize. So it sets a window in the plane, and then it counts all the samples from all of it, from each of the classes that fall inside the window. And then it says, I'm going to approximate the a posteriori probability by the proportion of samples of each of the classes. So if there's k samples inside the region, the proportion, the probability, the a posteriori probability of class I is basically the number of samples of that class divided by the total number of samples. I'm not assuming that anything is Gaussian. I'm not applying Bayes' rule. I'm just saying I can approximate the a posteriori probability by the proportion of samples that fall within the window. And this works surprisingly well. Okay, more examples. This is called the nearest neighbor rule. It's basically a suboptimal method that says the following. Suppose that these are all the samples of all the objects that I have. The nearest neighbor just goes to the plane and finds the sample that's closest to the one that I want to recognize. Okay? So it chooses the class that has the smallest distance with all of, it chooses the class that whose sample is closest to the sample that you're looking for. So what does it have to do? It has to measure the distance between the sample and all of the samples of all of the system. And the answer is going to be that class. No Gaussianity, no distributions of any sort, not even a posteriori probability. This, as I say, it's a suboptimal method, so we know that the error rate is higher, larger than Bayesian classification, but it's only double higher. So if you have a system that has an error rate of 5% using Bayes' theorem, it's going to have a rate of 10% of failure in this system, which is not very high for a surprisingly simple alternative, okay? So it's suboptimal, but it might be not so bad for certain applications. You can, of course, problem of computing distances with all the samples can be a complicated one. And and another alternative, which is the k-nearest neighbors, what the system does is choose the class which is more frequent among the first 10 neighbors or 20 neighbors or 101 neighbors. So suppose it's 101. What the system does is, what this algorithm does is compute the distance among between the sample and all of the samples of the classes, and then choose the k nearest. Then look which is the class that's more frequent in those k nearest, and that's your answer. Okay? It's similar to the nearest neighbor rule, or maybe that would be the one nearest neighbor, and this is the generalization, the k nearest neighbors. So find the closest ones, find the class that's more frequent in those closest one, and this is your answer. Okay? That's another alternative which works reasonably well. And as conclusion, these are only some examples of actually recognition algorithms for parametric recognition. I want to stress that these methods are extremely fast and they are frequently used because if the conditions hold, these methods have linear complexity. I'm basically comparing one sample with n classes linearly, and that allows me to produce an answer. So all of them have linear complexity. The conditions, I stress again, if the objects are like this, separated and complete, the system is going to work fine. If there's overlap, not going to work fine. If there's partial visibility, not going to work fine. In these cases, you have to carry out geometric recognition, as I said at the beginning. But if the condition holds, if the conditions hold, then these systems can perform very quickly and very efficiently. Any questions? Can I return to the exercise for a moment? Yes, I wanted to stress this exercise because it's useful to understand how the Mahalanobis distance works. And this exercise says, given an object characterized by M descriptors, and given a sample of each descriptor, for example, suppose it's two descriptors. So two questions. First, can each sample be compatible with its corresponding descriptor and nevertheless jointly incompatible? So this is better explained in the table, maybe. If I only have one sample, then one descriptor, and my confidence level is 0.5, then the limit value for the distance is 3.84, okay, for one. What if I have two? So let's go back to the question. Can each sample be compatible with its descriptor, and when you add the two, can the resulting sum be not compatible? So what would be the limit value for one? 38.4. If I have two individually, they could go up all the way to 3.84. If you add them, the answer is larger than 5.99. Okay? So samples can be individually compatible, but not jointly compatible. Basically, because statistically, the system will allow you to have a certain error in one or a certain error in the other, but jointly errors in both, that's like too much. Okay, so statistically you can have some error here or some error here, but a lot of error in both is too much. So the individual test could be passed, but the joint test will not be passed. And what about the other one? Can the sample be statistically incompatible, each one incompatible, some descriptors statistically incompatible, but then the samples jointly? Or if you want, can one of the descriptors not pass the test, but the sum pass the test? For example, let's go back to the table. So, can individually one of the samples not pass the test and jointly?
For example, let's say I have a one with distance 4 and one with distance 1.
Right. It wouldn't pass because the limit is 3.84. Okay, so one would pass because the distance is 1. The other one wouldn't pass because the distance is 4. And when you sum them, the joint distance is 5. So jointly, they would pass. This also statistically makes sense because that means if one of the descriptors has a small error, then the other one is allowed to have a larger error. Okay? So both can have a small error, one can have a large error, but the two together can't have a large error. That's the way statistics works. Okay? So this means that when you are analyzing the, when you are computing the Mahalanobis distance to carry out hypothesis tests, you have to do it always for all the descriptors that you're going to use. Because if you do it individually, the answer individually may be no, even if the answer jointly is yes. Okay? So always you have to use all the descriptors that you have, which is the joint answer that you're looking for, actually. Okay? All very clear? Okay, I'll see you then after Easter.